And Finance and Revenue is open. Good morning, everyone. We have an informational meeting today on debt. And without further ado, we'll bring up the Treasurer's Office. Laura Lockwood McCall has been our resident expert on this subject. She has to leave to do a billion-dollar bond bid at 9 o'clock.
Only a $70 million bid open.
Yeah. We know where we stand at the pecking order, and we'll get out of your way as soon as you give us your report.
Thank you. Good morning. For the record, my name is Laura Lockwood McCall. I'm the Director of the Debt Management Division. I think that many of you have seen this presentation before. And so in the interest of time, other than Senator perhaps Taylor, this is our annual presentation on the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission report. We send that to each member of the legislature each session. I know that you're very busy. So I'm going to go fairly high level. As I said, we're opening bids for the school bond 11P match at 9 o'clock. Others can do it, but I need to award a bid at about 9:15. So the report this year, just briefly, it's a five-member commission set up in the statute, and it's made of five members. The treasurer is always the chair. We have two representatives from the legislature. Currently, Senator Devlin represents the Senate, and Representative Barnhart has been a longstanding member from the House, the director of DAS, and then also a public member. And our current public member is Tim Dewey, who is an economist at the University of Oregon. So we provide a framework each year as the legislature goes through the analysis of how much bonding they want to accomplish in a given two-year period. We're also trying to help highlight or spot emerging issues of concern from a debt management perspective for future policy consideration. There's four major categories of debt. The main general obligation bonds is what we spend a lot of time talking about in our Constitution. We can't sell more than $50,000 in debt. We can't basically give our full faith and credit without a carve-out in the Constitution in Article 11. So that means that voters have to approve if we're going to sell bonds for universities or for public schools. So you'll hear about Article 11Q or P or these different letters. And those are all different voter approvals over the years for different bond programs. Both general fund supported debt and self-supporting debt is included. We have a number of loan programs that are general obligation bonds, so we don't consider them part of the debt capacity. Their own capacity is determined by their loan portfolio and the revenue streams coming in. Direct revenue bonds are where we pledge a specific revenue stream. It's not the full faith and credit of the state. It is state debt. So examples would include lottery bonds, highway user tax bonds, and we also have a single-family and multifamily revenue bond programs. And lastly, we are the conduit issuer, which means that we're providing the federal tax exemption for a number of different types of programs where the state is not on the hook. We put that in big bold letters on the cover of every official statement. The three big programs are Oregon Facilities Authority, which is managed through my office for nonprofit financings around the state. We also have multifamily housing programs, and we do industrial development bonds through Oregon Business Development Department. This is a snapshot of our indebtedness of the major categories of state-backed debt over the last decade. And what you'll see is that we started in 2007 slightly below $10 billion, and we're slightly above $10 billion now. In terms of where the growth has been and where the reductions have been, you'll see that really it's our GO bonds, other than the pension obligation bonds, which I'll talk about, has been our area of growth. And the big area of decline has been appropriation credits. We used to sell COPs for things that were very attractive, appealing to the voters, like mental hospitals, prisons. And then several years ago, we passed Article 11Q, which said, why don't you make those GO bonds rather than COPs, better credit rating, lower interest cost? And over the last several years, we've been refunding whenever market rates are available into the GO mode, as well as issuing new GO bonds for various facilities for the state. And we've saved in the neighborhood of $92 million just on that one program alone in terms of lowering our interest cost on COP debt. And please stop me if you have questions, but I'm going to keep zooming. This just shows you the different components of our GO bonds. And the growth, as I said, has been in the Qs. You can see the pension obligation bonds have not really dropped all that much over the last decade in terms of outstanding, and that we're really slowly amortizing the principal. We still have 85% of what was initially issued 13 years ago in pension bonds based on the amortization structure.
Could you explain pension bonds a little bit better?
Sure. So
pension, I'm not an expert like this.
She is now.
I am now.
Through the chair. The state sold pension obligation bonds in 2003, and basically they got voter approval to sell them in a general obligation mode before they were sold. They could have been sold as simply appropriation bonds, but it was a lower interest cost to sell them as full faith and credit. Some communities locally sell them as full faith and credit as well. Basically, communities decided to sell those bonds and then use those funds to put in a side account at PERS to address previous unfunded liabilities.
So the hope was that their returns would be higher than the
game plan when you sell pension bonds is that you are making a calculated risk that over the life of your bonds, you'll earn a higher rate of return on your side account than what the unfunded liability accrual rate would be. But you can't really know till the end of the bond period whether you were right or wrong. And what's super important is that you have to earn a really good rate of return in the first few years in particular, because it's a corpus that sits off to the side. And if you have to, they dig into the corpus, not based on what you return, but by a preset formula. So if you earn below the accrual rate, then they're going to be taking more. So think of it as an endowment. You know, you want to spin off a certain amount. So those who sold POBs in the early 2000s did pretty well so far. I'd say that we're ahead of breaking even at this point. Those communities that sold in 07, 08 entered, you know, sold, put the side account in place, and then the stock market dropped by 25%. So that's where the risk comes in, particularly if you sell POBs at the top of a market, that's probably not as wise as selling POBs at the bottom of the market. You can't really know, as I said, but as I said, the first few years can have a profound effect on what the rate of return you have to ultimately earn in order for it to have been a good deal. The other point I'd make is that when we sold them, and I wasn't here at the time, they were sold 25-year bonds with very little amortization of principal in the first 5 years because we were in the middle of a huge budget crisis. As a result, that's why we're only beginning to start amortizing. So we sold $2 billion in 2003, of which $1.8 billion still remained outstanding 13 years later. So we got budget relief, but at a trade-off. And it had an upward-sloping amortization of principal because people assumed that your PERS liabilities would go upward because of payroll growth. But it's eaten up a lot of state debt capacity under this model that could have been used for infrastructure and capital projects around the state. So it did help budgetarily, but there's some trade-offs. So if it's okay to go on? So these are our direct revenue bonds. And you can see that we definitely had a big increase in those bonds between the latter part of the 2000s. And it's more or less leveled off. And the real growth is in the ODOT programs. Those were the OTIA 1, 2, and 3 bonding authorizations as we bonded out all of that. And as we've been also issuing the Jobs and Transportation Act bonds. Other programs have shrunk during that period, particularly in the area of single first-time homebuyer loans. Interest rates have been pretty low, and it's difficult for us to earn a spread between the borrowing rate and the loan rate. And so that program has declined quite a bit. There's also fewer buyers of those bonds because Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae are no longer active in those markets, which were always big buyers of our bonds. And then you can just see, as I said, the COPs dropping off. Now, we will have COPs through the life for the next decade because some of our COPs were sold for correctional facilities at the local level. And one of the things in the constitutional amendment for the Qs was we can sell GO bonds if it's owned or operated by the state. And so obviously when you have a correctional facility that's owned at the local level, we can't refund those into Qs. So we will have a little tail. The red that you see that sort of went away were the appropriation deficit bonds that were sold at the same period as the POBs were sold, and those were to help balance the state budget in a crisis. We were downgraded as a result of selling those bonds. Sadly, it took us a decade to pay those off. Sadly, we didn't put in a call feature because we were selling we started getting better, our credit rating improved, and we could have used kicker money, for example, to pay off those bonds, but we didn't have a way to do it, so we just had to live with that. Again, it ate up a lot of state debt capacity, and we had to dig our way out of the cellar in terms of credit ratings, which we did, and now we're a AA plus, solid across the board for our GO ratings. When we do the debt capacity analysis with the commission each year, we focus primarily on two areas, the general fund supported debt and the lottery backed debt. The rule of thumb that we've been using for as long as I've worked here, which is now going on 13 years, is the goal is to keep our debt service at no more than 5% of our operating revenues for general fund debt. There's no magic to it. There are some states that have lower ratios, some that have higher, but that's probably the average among states, and that's been our rule of thumb. So these are all the different kinds of bonds in the GO and appropriation areas that make up our general fund supported debt. Not every program is 100% general funded, and we've tried to show that. Probably the most important thing is our pension obligation bonds. Only 33% of payroll is general fund. So all the other state agencies that were part of the pension bonds that we sold historically, transportation, universities, health, everybody who's not in the general fund pays over 2/3 of the annual debt service. And it's the biggest single debt service we have, so that's important in terms of how much capacity it really sucks down. So we were at about the same exact number a year ago when I was here. So what's happening is we're paying off old debt and we're bringing new debt on, but a lot of the bond bill that was authorized by the 15 and 16 legislature had us selling bonds this spring. So one of the reasons I have to run is that most of the bonds that were authorized, the GO bonds, are all being sold this spring. And no kidding, it's $1.5 billion over the next 2 months. The good news is we just sold $475 million for the Q bonds, for our seismic M's and N's, as well as some refunding of some energy bonds, and our all-in cost of funds was just slightly north of 3% for 25 years, which is a testimony to our good financial practices and our strong credit rating. So in this model, these are all the bonds that were authorized that are part of our analysis. We assume that we sell all the bonds that were authorized in the bond bill. And then we use the 10-year horizon of revenue forecasts that OEA provides each quarter. And we're using the December forecast because the report came out in January. And we assumed a 4.5% interest rate, which is well above our current rate. But to be conservative, we try and stay a little higher. And then the 5% target. So we basically just figure out, well, okay, how much could we leverage given those parameters? And what you find is that our ratios, because we aren't issuing a lot of bonds until now, so the debt service hits next biennium, over the next decade or so, we have roughly $4.57 billion in available capacity. And all the model does is say, okay, what does it take to get to 5% each year? But the commission rarely suggests that we sell all of our bonds at once because revenues could drop, interest rates could go up, and it's also sort of an equity issue about spreading some of the projects over time. So we use averaging, and we take that total forecast.
Could you slip back one slide?
Sure.
Just jumping out here, I mean, 18 is 1.3, and then suddenly we drop. Why is there such a big difference?
Well, because once you sell bonds, then you get to pay debt service every year. So really all that first year is doing is sucking up all that available revenue. Mm-hmm. But as I was about to say, we suggest that we don't sell all the bonds right away, but instead spread it out over time. So we take the grand total for that 10-year period, and then we say if we do it in a more measured way, it's about $1.14 billion per biennium. It's because we haven't been selling bonds, our revenues have been growing, that we sort of have latent capacity if we wanted to use it at once. And we have the same thing with lottery bonds. You'll see a pop because we haven't been selling lottery bonds at as frequent a clip. But again, in general, we suggest averaging it. You can see sensitivity analysis that if revenues over the 10-year horizon drop by 10% in the revenue forecast, we would need to clip our wings a little bit in terms of how much we issue. And obviously, if rates go up, then there would also be an impact. But I think we've covered interest rates pretty carefully.
Follow up, Senator Buckley.
So in simple, being a stupid farmer, okay, in simple terms, at some point, are you going to tell us what is really the amount that we should not exceed in the next biennium?
Generally speaking, the commission, through the chair, has said don't exceed the 1/4 of the balance of what you have. Would the world come to an end if you went up a little bit more than that? No. But it's been a philosophy that the state tries to stay around that number each biennium.
And so the number is right up there.
That's the $1.14 billion.
Don't bond more than that.
That has been the commission's recommendations, as I said, since I've worked here, is to always look ahead, divide it up. One of the reasons that I think it's been useful is that it allows people to do longer-term capital planning, mm-hmm. and to know that, you know, each biennium there'll be projects, and a lot of university projects and other projects like the state capital, they'll stretch beyond a biennium, and so it's sort of that's the attempt at equity, that you spread your capital program over a number of years, and so that a number of projects can get going, and over time they'll have confidence that there'll be capacity to complete their projects. So if I could keep going to lottery. Lottery bonds is, again, a revenue pledge, so it's purely the revenue streams of the lottery program that pay the debt service. We were the first state in the country that bonded against our lottery program, and at the time that we did that, it was kind of unusual. So we have pretty high coverage, which means that we pledge that we won't bond off more than 25%. Four times coverage means no more than 25% of total net lottery revenues would be pledged to debt, and that's the capacity consideration that we've been using. We could open up a junior indenture and go to three times coverage. We go to two times coverage. We won't be quite as high a credit rating, but we haven't ever even suggested that because lottery revenues, actual lottery dollars, are so important to fund so many different state programs that we felt that that was appropriate. But there's a lot of pressure on use of lottery bonding, as you'll know, during the capital planning and the bonding bill. So again, it's a policy consideration by the legislature. State Treasurer's Office could accommodate if you wanted to go higher, but I think the implications, once you borrow for, bond for lottery dollars, then that's the first use as you do the bucket drops in the state constitution in terms of who has to get paid every year. But you can see the wide range of projects that get funded through lottery bonds. We, again, in the model, assumed all $213 million that was authorized by the legislature will get sold, and that actually, I'm doing rating calls this afternoon to go through that with the rating agencies, and we'll be selling in mid-March for those bonds. We use the same revenue forecast from December for lottery for the long haul. We use the same interest rate, the same term, but with this differential, which is no more than 25% of lottery revenue forecasted dollars could be used for debt service. Just as a step back, for the last few years, it's been tricky to do bonding for lottery because the long-term revenue forecast has moved around, as you know. The red line shows you where we were in 2015, and the circle shows you when we were doing the video lottery replacement program that the net transfers to the state had dropped quite a bit, which pushed us right up against our coverage limits, and so we had to back off in selling lottery bonds for a while. The blue line is where we were a year ago. And as you can see, the OEA modified their forecast because we are now past the video lottery replacement. We're seeing really good sales. And you can see in the yellow line, which is the most current forecast, it's even better. Having said that, you see the drop in the yellow, and that's a recognition that the La Center Casino will be opening during that time frame. And right now, at least, we're telling the rating agencies, and I guess OEA is telling you all, that we will probably see some competition that will dig into some of our revenue streams. So we have to kind of use that in our presentations with rating folks, trying to always be conservative, whether it exactly happens that way or not. We have a AAA rating with S&P for our lottery bond program, which is great because of our high coverage and also because of our conservative revenue forecasting. So the results show you that because we've taken a little bit of a holiday and because revenues are better than we thought, that we'll actually be at 5.6, which means that less than 20% of our lottery revenues are going for debt service through the end of this year. Again, the model just says, okay, let's go back to four times or 25%. And you can see a big pop in the first year, and then it spreads out over time. And again, we do the same thing, which is, what's the value over the balance of that forecast period? Let's divide by four bienniums, and that's how we get $209 million per biennium. So the same answer to Senator Boquist was just this: the world doesn't come to an end if you go a little higher than that. But the trade-off is twofold. One is that probably is taking capacity out from out years in the forecast, but also to the extent that you're using lottery dollars to pay debt service, you're not having lottery dollars for education and for all the bucket drops, other places where the money might otherwise go. And a big decline again would really shrink our program. And so one of the things in our rating presentation today is we talk about other forces besides the La Center Casino. There's other forces that I'm sure you're aware of in terms of internet gambling and other sort of forces that are affecting our lottery program that could shrink our capacity in out years. Are there any questions on lottery? So net tax-supported debt is the way that the rating agencies compare us to other states, because not every state has an ODOT standalone revenue program or a lottery program. So they take all the debt that every state has, and then in our case, and they try and compare apples to apples as best they can. So to do that, they throw in all our pension obligation bonds, not just support that's paid by the general fund. They throw in all of our COPs and Q bonds that are self-supporting, our lottery bonds, and our highway user bonds. So this is just a high-level summary of our total net tax-supported debt. And you can see we're projecting going to $8.8 billion once we sell all the bonds that were authorized this year. And the per capita and the net tax-supported debt as a percentage of personal income. So when Moody's looks at us versus others, and they add all those different types of debt, the green bars shows you what the 50-state medians are. And this is just the personal income, but per capita would look very, very similar. And what you see is that if we only took the first four lines of my cake, we would be at or below those medians. The two things that drive us above it are the ODOT bonds, because we have had a pretty large transportation program to catch up with our need for modernization and bridge seismic and highway upgrades. And then the POBs that sit on top of the cake. And not every state has sold POBs. Some states have either lower unfunded liabilities or they have large ones, but they've just kept it on their balance sheet, but not public debt. And Moody's only recently has kind of come to realize that actually there's more unfunded liability on balance sheets than there is public debt in the United States. So the perspective of, you know, what's a debt and how to look at it. So S&P's done, I think, a better job. This is a report that came out in September from S&P, and they've taken the financial reports from all 50 states. They're looking at your public debt per capita as well as your balance sheet debt, which is the net pension liability, and then also OPEB, which is other post-employment benefits. Now, the caveat here is that our CAFR from the year that they used did not include the Morrow decision, so we may look a little better than we really are in this particular snapshot, because the per capita number is going to go up for us on the blue public debt on the balance sheet debt once the OPEB, the PERS liability is added, because it wasn't really there because of they hadn't booked the PERS liabilities. But I think what the green line is showing you is the gross state product. And the goal here is to say, what kind of resources does each state have to address its combined liabilities, balance sheet, as well as its public debt? And you can see the states off to the right, which somebody mentioned yesterday was the Titanic. They not only have large public debt, which is the yellow, but they have really enormous pension liability and OPEB debt as a percentage of their gross state product. It's eating up a tremendous amount of their overall state product, or could, theoretically. We're still in the pack where it's considered moderate and modest, and again, we'll get a new report in a year from S&P, and I'll bring that to show you how we look after the Morrow decision's folded in to the analysis.
Question to the left here.
Senator Boquist.
No, Senator
thank
Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Hass. I just was curious on that slide where, if you were to guess, we won't hold you to it or anything, where
sure.
Would you see Oregon move?
Well, let's do the quick math. I think that our the Morrow decision, I want to say it's going to move us, the state's pension liability, let's just guess it's going to be about $3 million. $3 billion at a zero. And we have about $4 billion. We have about it's going to move us about $3 billion-ish. And we have how many people do we have living in Oregon?
Multiply. Four million.
Yeah, so it's going to you can do the math, but I think it's going to move us at least $1,000 per capita for our balance sheet debt. Am I, do they do the math right? I think so. So it's going to bump us up.
So we'll be by Kansas? Is that what you're saying?
Oh, if I were going to guess.
I can't quite see the...
Yeah, we're probably going to get closer to Kansas. So we're going to definitely move to the right. Now, every state's also going to have their liability move for whatever's going on in their world and whatever public debt that they did. Mm-hmm. I'm anxious to see how it all unfolds.
Okay, thank you.
The last quickie is the non-tax supported debt. These are all the self-supporting bonding programs we have. And for the most part, they have loans that, or they have enterprises or different things that fund their debt. In the case of GO bonds, we have a number of programs. You've heard a bit about the energy program and how its loan portfolio is no longer in the long run going to be able to support its debt. They had a number of defaults on loans. There was a task force by the interim, there's an interim committee that did a review of the SELP program, which is the small scale energy loan program. We predicted that over time that about $16 million in general fund resources will be needed to help pay their debt service on their GO bonds based on the fact that their loan reserves have been more or less depleted. Happy to say that we just refunded some of their bonds, and we've reduced that $16 million probably by $2.5 million over time because we were able to take advantage of interest rates. They have to share their savings under their loan agreements with their loanees, so we don't get to keep every penny of the money that we were able to achieve in savings. But I think the commission or the interim task force recommended, and there's a bill who's in the House that was introduced by Representative Hovley and Senator Beyer that would move the SELP loan program over to Business Oregon. They have a lot of loan officers who are a bit more focused on the business aspects of loaning rather than on maybe the cool energy-ness of loaning. And so both the commission and I think the task force recommend that this be moved over, but by no means will the general fund escape having to cover some of the debt service starting in about fiscal year 21. It's about $1 to $2 million a year, which doesn't seem huge, but nevertheless, the goal is for all of our self-supporting programs to remain 100% self-supporting. Lastly, this is something that I've been talking about for years. I'm sure the chair is tired of hearing about it, but we have a contingent liability in the Oregon School Bond Guarantee. It's a program that's been around for a long time. When the state was not as great a credit rating, the school districts could either, when they got voter-approved GO bonds, they could either go get private bond insurance from the AAA bond insurers or the state guarantee. And many of them went and got the AAA rating because even though it cost them something, they got such a bang for their buck in terms of that AAA and their bonds. All those bond insurance companies went away in 2008-09, and the state's credit rating improved. So we become the bond insurer of choice. And our in terms of what we're paying, in terms of a contingent liability, that's grown from $165 million a year of debt service that we're guaranteeing gets paid. And we've never actually had a draw, one penny of it, but it's exceeding $500 million a year. And so as I look forward, I think that there are bond insurance companies available in the AA range. And so an issue that's emerging, if you will, is whether the states really should continue to guarantee. We're not really charging more than a small fee for processing the guarantee, but it is a growing liability on our balance sheet, contingent nevertheless. If there was a serious event, an earthquake, tsunami, the very likelihood is that the communities would not be in a position from a property tax base perspective to repay for several years at least. And even if a small percentage of that $500 million becomes real, we would have to make sure that we paid that debt service one way or the other. And so it's a question of, you know, what is the appropriate level for us and whether a community should look to the private sector for insurance or to the state. That's the end of my remarks. The conclusion is really just the numbers that I've shared with you. And I'm happy to answer any other questions you might have.
Always interesting. Thank you. The kicker still gets a downgraded rating for us, the rating agency.
To the chair, I think that the state has done an excellent job of building deeper reserves. And while the kicker is something that they always discuss in our reports, the corporate kicker now goes to the reserves. And we have really beefed up our rainy day fund and the mechanisms how we continue to fund it through the 1% remaining fund balance. So I don't think they emphasize it as much as they used to, because one way or the other, we've been able to build our reserves. I think that the lack of diversity in our income streams, if you will, in terms of our taxes, is the final frontier to raise our credit rating. They do mention that in the initiative process generally, is the credit risks to our credit.
Okay.
Senator Booker. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned early on you full faith and credit of the state. Are not all of our bonds actually backed by the full credit of the state, regardless of this, legally?
Through the chair, Senator Boquist, I would say that morally, legally, versus pragmatically, the answer is yes, but there is a legal differential between a general obligation, full faith and credit, versus the appropriation credits, because, and that's why they're rated one notch below our GO rating. Even our lottery bonds have a moral obligation pledge behind them that we would replenish a reserve fund if the reserves, debt service reserves, ever got hit. But truthfully, if we don't pay debt service on any of our bonds, it would affect our credit rating and our long-standing relationship with the credit markets.
Article 9 of the Constitution has a clause in it, and I'm curious of your agency's response to this, and you don't have to respond now.
I don't know if I know what it is.
And you might want to write it down, but Article 9 has a clause in it that says that regardless of whatever the debt is, the expense is, regardless of whether the legislature encumbered it, if the executive branch encumbers a debt or we have any debt or expense out there against the state of Oregon, we are mandated by Article 9 of the Constitution to honor that debt and pay it in full through the legislature. And so I'm just curious if someplace in your entity, Department of Justice, has opined on that or come up with that, because that really means the full faith and credit, regardless of whether the legislature agreed or disagreed, is guaranteed in the Oregon Constitution to these bond payers.
I would need, through the chair, I need to do more research. I don't think that it's come across my radar. Whether that's contracts and things that might be something I could talk to Department of Justice about.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. I'd just like to make, because this is actually a new twist from Legislative Council. And there is no requirement to balance the budget either, by the way.
Thank you. Always interesting. I feel if we don't let you go, a Bonneville Dam won't get built or something. So
no, I don't think so.
Can't afford a Bonneville at $1.1 billion. I just want you to know that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Keeping with the theme of debt, we're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 564. And are you going to give us a briefing on this?
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 564 primarily takes one of the concepts that you've been briefed on, which is the 5% ceiling on payments of debt service payments from the general fund, and enacted or puts it in legal language or legal requirements. So that's what the bill does, is put that 5% from the general fund limit.
Thank you. And the sponsor of this bill is Senator Girod. He's here.
Thank you, Chair Haas. My name is Fred Girod. I represent Senate District 9, which is the rural part of Clackamas, Marion, and Linn County. Colleagues, Senate Bill 564, I think I have a chance of getting passed, because Senate Bill 564 absolutely does nothing. And the reason it does nothing is that this is the policy that we have enacted and the limitations that we've put on ourselves. This bill simply locks that limitation into statute. Now, as you know, statutes can be overturned, but it's simply one more hurdle before we venture off and try to enact a higher debt stream than what we're using right now. I think it's important to do something like this just so that we are prudent. And the fact that you're having discussions about debt, I think, is a very prudent discussion to have. And just so you know, I actually tried to get the same bill for lottery at 25%, but LC had problems writing the bill. So this bill is general obligation. It's, again, at 5%, and it's what we use down in capital construction for our limitation. And, again, we're very prudent about doing that, but I'm not sure down the stream somebody else is going to have the same points of view, and I just wanted to make it more difficult for anybody to go above that limit and jeopardize the cash flow of general funds. So that's the reason for the bill. It's a very simple bill, and it really is what we are doing right now.
Say there's a tsunami or an earthquake and the need comes up.
Then all we have to do is override the statute. It's not, it's a simple majority vote, and I think in that circumstance we probably could do that. But, you know, if you wanted an opt-out for emergency, but, I mean, it's a statute. It's not locked in the Constitution. But what I don't want is just to say, hey, we've fallen on hard times, so we're going to bond ourselves or use bond money for general fund expenditures. That's something I don't want. And you saw graphs of some states that have done that, and it's kind of scary, and I just don't want to go down that pathway.
Well, I think we did go down that pathway in 2003. It was the last resort. So...
2000. There, I also have another bill that I dropped, and I don't know the number on it, but it was a spending limitations bill that I would like you to look at, and it sets limits as to what we can actually spend. I know that you're dealing with a revenue package, and I also know that there are a lot of businesses that, you know, want some guarantees. It's one of those things that you might look at to be part of a package so that there are spending limitations that would go with any increase in revenue. That's just something I would suggest. And I don't remember the name, the number on the bill.
Okay. Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Notwithstanding, that's the magic words. I mean, you just insert notwithstanding this bill. If we pass it, then we can, you know, do more bonding, so on and so forth. But to a more fundamental question, Senator Girod, because you sat in here and you've lectured many of us in here on this particular issue for years, but looking very specifically at the presentation that they made before, as example, this year the Debt Advisory Board is saying to stay within the general 5%, you should not bond more than $1.5 billion in the next biennium. And so if we complied with that guideline from them and passed your bill, we would still have $1.1 billion in general fund ability to bond this biennium, correct?
I really honestly, Senator Boquist, have not been, I haven't been given the numbers myself. So I think that the presentation that you had, I got here late, so I can't really testify as to the numbers. But
I'm going to help you.
No, it is correct.
Okay, thank you. Yes. Senator Boquist, that's correct.
Right, see, look at that. So help me out, follow Mr.
Senator Boquist.
Chair, I mean, and you two, can, you know, he's your staff now, Senator. So somebody help me out here and understand when we just said up here that there's $1.2 billion in available bonding. Is that the total value of the bonds? Is that how much additional we can encumber and then bond at a 12-to-1 ratio? Or
it's the cash flow. It's the cost of the bond.
Right.
So what you measure is how much cash it's going to take, and that the cash payment on that bond can only equal the 5% of the revenue stream.
Okay, so follow up, Mr. Chair. Follow. Let Mazen jump in here. So,
so the 5% that the bill requires, what it says is you need to figure out how much you're paying today. So that takes out of the 5%. Then that opens up how much debt service you could mm-hmm. pay. And that allows you for the bond. And that, calculating that amount, you get $1.1 billion bonding capacity.
follow, Mr. Chair?
I would assume that's for just general fund. That's not
that
for
correct.
Lottery.
Just for the general fund.
Yeah. That's about it. Since I've been chair, that's pretty much been about the starting number.
So follow, Mr. Chair? So, and I think it's more for Mazen, but I think Senator Drodny is the comment because it's the holistic package of all of this bonding. In the Joint Transportation Committee, what we're discussing in there right now, there's roughly a 12-to-1 ratio. If you bonded $100 million, you could raise $1.2 billion, roughly a 12-to-1 ratio. If we bond money in the Joint Transportation Committee, is that coming out of the general fund cap, or does that come out of a different bonding cap that we're talking about?
I think, Mr. Chair, that would be out of the general,
general
bonds. This would be a revenue bond against the revenues, the highway revenue.
It comes out of highway money.
Right. Yeah, so that's
the transportation user. Or the revenue?
Highway user bonds is basically in the class of revenue bonds.
Is the highway and the transportation the same?
But that doesn't go through capital construction. That's separate from us.
But follow me, sure. This is where it starts getting complicated because Connect Oregon and some of the other pieces do in fact.
Well, Connect Oregon does go through us.
Yeah, because Connect Oregon is primarily a lottery-backed bond. So if it's a lottery-backed bond, it's a different type of bond than the highway user bond. However, they're both in the what's so-called revenue bond. Because it's a special revenue stream, it is not the general fund stream. So it depends on what your payment comes from. If it's the general fund, then it's the general obligation bond. If it's from a dedicated special revenue stream, like the highway fund or some other highway revenue, then it's a revenue bond.
I need to correct myself. When I said the $1.1 billion that we have, that is the total amount that we can bond. I might have misspoke. That is the total, actually, dollar amount of the bonds that we're selling. But how that's calculated is predicated on the cost of those bonds.
Okay, now I'm confused, Mazen. Help me out here.
No, I confused you. I'm sorry, but
so is the $1.1 billion the total amount we can raise, or is it the total amount of cash flow we can utilize?
It's the total amount that you can actually, if you were looking to bond and the cost of the bond, that's what we're talking about. How that's calculated, though, is 5% of the cash flow that it costs for those bonds. And all the other debt that we've incurred before, the cash payment of that is where the 5% comes in. So we can't spend more than 5%. We can't spend more than 5% of the cash flow of the general fund is basically what it boils down to.
Okay.
Did I totally confuse everybody?
Well, I think that the only thing that is confusing, Mr. Chair, and the thing is that this biennium, because of what we've done last biennium, so it kind of opened up our ability to bond a little bigger than the past. So if you want to bond everything that we, up to that 5%, you'll have the ability to bond this biennium at $1.3
billion. Right.
Okay. Since we want to average it and leave enough space for the next biennium, the recommendation from the advisory commission, the debt advisory commission, is only do 1.1, mm-hmm. and that 1.1 billion is a general fund only ceiling. So, the subcommittee capital construction, they will have a recommendation of bonds of 1.1 billion for the general fund. Other bonds of different amounts.
I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but there are some bonds that doesn't apply to. I think F bonds, for example. So, like, if a university fully bonds itself, that doesn't apply.
That's not a general fund.
That's not a general fund obligation.
Mr. Chair, what would be helpful is to have LRO just do us a one-page cheat sheet here, because this is going to become exceptionally important as discussions go forward in this particular legislative session of, like, are our realistic caps in each of these areas that across the board? Because, I mean, this is being discussed across the board, and as I made mention earlier, I mean, Article 9, the most recent twist in all of these discussions of what you can spend, what you can bond, so on and so forth, is another interpretation of Article 9 that is actually alarming
at this point. Chair Haas, Senator Boquist, and that's the reason I brought F bonds up, and that was one of the reasons that I opposed. I was one of the few that opposed giving colleges that outright use of bonding, because if for some reason they have trouble meeting their obligation, it falls on the obligation of the state, even though, I mean, we're not technically on the bond.
So. Mr. Bertschinger, do you have a question?
Yeah, real quick. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Girard, you know me, I'm a pretty simple guy, but my understanding of the general fund bonds, I think where some people is the 5% is tied to our budget. And so when mm-hmm. our budget changes, the 5% number changes, mm-hmm. which changes the bonding capacity.
Well, that's true. And we also, Chair Haas, Senator Bertschinger, also please be aware that we are paying off bonds as we go. So we've had this system in place now for quite a while, and so we do actually pay off some of our obligation bonds as we go. So that opens up the ceiling as well.
Okay. Senator Riley?
Did that help you?
Thanks for bringing this forward.
Yeah.
And thanks for the discussion, and I'll talk to you later about the
spending bill. And when you get that sheet explaining all the bonds, send
yes.
a copy up to
me.
We'll
need a little glossary.
It is very confusing.
Yeah. All right, well, thank you, Senator Girard. You have your homework. This is our last meeting. This week.
I was thinking for the session. We're
I was hoping you were saying something else. But.
Yeah. So, unless you're here differently, until next Monday at 8:30, we are adjourned.
Thank you.
Monday at 8:30, we are adjourned.